The Men's Choir. The northeast of the United States, much like continental Europe, moved away from its Christian history. Evangelical churches have been difficult to start in that area and tend to remain small, with few exceptions. So it was with great joy that I watched a real Bible-teaching church get started and grow steadily on the outskirts of Boston. As the church grew in the number of men, they asked me to come and conduct a men's retreat, something I commonly do, and I gladly obliged. At the retreat, which occurred on Cape Cod, one of the men suggested that they take some time to practice a few of the favorite worship songs, and when they returned, lead the worship service on the following Sunday night. Oh, this was a big event, because it was the first time the church had planned to even meet on Sunday night. Well, there was a little hesitancy because of their feelings of inadequacy, but the plans progressed, and frankly, as I listened to their practice, I wasn't sure practice was going to help them, but they persisted. When Sunday night arrived and the service began, much to the surprise of the people, the men made their way to the platform to lead the worship service. They even asked me to get in on the act. However, the whole thing almost didn't happen. When the wives saw their husbands doing something they, in their wildest dreams, never thought would happen, when they saw them assuming spiritual leadership, when they saw them actually up front worshiping God, they, the wives, lost it. Sobs of joy came from every corner of that auditorium. Now, you can finish this, can't you? These men, seeing their wives weep, were overwhelmed by the power of the event and barely scratched out songs between their own sobs. I wept unashamedly. Questions. When have you seen such a spiritual victory that it caused you to weep? 2. What, if anything, touches you so deeply that you can't successfully participate without crying? Jesse. He owned the house where I was born. In fact, he owned the house where my father was born, on the same farm. In further fact, the same doctor that traveled 23 miles to deliver my father traveled the same distance to deliver me about 23 years later. Jesse's house and farm carry more warm memories than any spot of my childhood. I risked life and limb climbing to the peak of his barns by gripping the edge of 10 roofing sheets. His hogs lost unknown pounds of weight because of running to the slop trough at the sound of my hog calling practice. The Oklahoma plains became exciting scenery as I climbed to the top of his windmills. His cattle watering tanks served as swimming pools, though I had to push the occasional pond scum aside. His tractors and combine merited hours of just riding along to be with him. In his battered pickup, I, by the way, helped batter it, I rode shotgun and watched the cattle come running when we entered the pasture. That pickup meant food. The horse he provided me was beautiful and gentle. I thought it was mine, but I found out that a lot of my cousins thought the horse was theirs. Okay. I was free to saddle the horse at age 7 and ride him anywhere I wanted. As a city dweller now, I find the next statement very hard to believe myself. But his wife, my grandmother, would make a lunch for me, and I would ride down to the river bottom with a rifle and a box of 22 shells and stay until the box was empty. I had only one warning. Don't shoot any of the cows or horses or any deer or, as it was strongly hinted, anything alive. I helped him, Jess, spread fodder as he ground it and blew it into silos. I ate, and I mean really ate, at his table. I can still smell the bread baking and the slop bucket kept just outside the kitchen door. You see, nothing was wasted. I used his outhouse, a two-holer, 40 yards out the back of the chicken yard. I probably need therapy from the visits to that outhouse at 20 below zero temperatures. I remember his phone, a wall-hanging box with a tube sticking out and a handle on the side that, when vigorously spun in certain code lengths, would produce a person speaking on the other end. I marveled that the wires supporting the phone system were often simple fence wires grafted into the flow. I discovered also that there was no such thing as a private line. I was impressed that, way ahead of others, he had constructed a wind charger, a generator that captured power from Oklahoma winds, which were plentiful, and stored the electricity in a garage filled with batteries to provide real and better light than the dangerous kerosene lamps. When the high line, as they called it, came, he was already wired and ready. He also had rigged up a water tank that provided running water for his house and then, whee, brought the toilets indoors. I knew he could do anything. At night, I would drift off to sleep to the sound of coyotes howling and awaken to the crowing of roosters. His workshop had no lock, to his misfortune, I might say, so I spent many hours there testing different tools in, well, in ways they were not designed. Spinning the blower on his forge provided endless hours of mindless fun. Life could get no better. But it certainly could get worse. School meant a long bus ride, since only about one house occupied each square mile of land. Classrooms became places for me to daydream and sleep and be punished. The farm was much more enticing. Time and tides ended his farm days, and he and my grandmother moved to the city. There, many years after I had left the farm, I re-entered their lives in a way most beneficial to me. I lived with them for an extended period of time as I finished junior high school. The hours I spent at Jess's feet in Bible study are priceless. A footnote here. In 1999, while teaching at the Billy Graham Training Center, known as The Cove, in Asheville, North Carolina, I met a granddaughter of Dr. Leachman, the doctor who had delivered me and my father. Her name is Gail. Questions. What are some of the warmest memories you have of your grandparents? 2. In what ways do you feel your grandparents influenced you? If you don't remember your grandparents, how would you describe the grandfather you would like to have? The Torch. In 1984, when the Olympic Games came to Los Angeles, one of the gimmicks used to create interest was a torch run across the United States. Fire taken from the altar of Zeus at Mount Olympus in Athens and carried by torch runners finally makes its way in a dramatic ceremony to light the flame that begins the games. Frankly, folks, this is strange fire that would have brought on even more fireworks had it occurred in the camp of Israel in the Old Testament. God demanded that only fire that he himself started was to be used in the tabernacle, and anyone using any other fire would be killed. You can read that in Leviticus chapter 10, verses 1 and 2. However, the torch run created so much excitement that other groups decided to do their own and more Christian version, whatever that is, of the run. One religious group used the torch to celebrate a milestone, a birthday of the group. The torch was to run from their organizational birthplace and eventually arrive at a conference in a city hundreds of miles away. The run, timed to culminate on a specific celebrative evening, arrived at the dramatic moment with the crowd in a high emotional state. One small problem. As the torch reached the stage and the crowd reached a crescendo, the fire went out. Emotions fell as rapidly as they had risen. What were they to do now? It was a non-smoking group, and no one had matches or a lighter. At least no one would admit it. Finally, a convention center employee brought a match, and the excitement, though not quite so intense and now carrying a humorous edge, returned. Questions. Can you think of other places or ways where we have Greek or Roman god names or practices? 2. What programs have collapsed at some point in your life? Was it embarrassing? Embarrassment. Only 2 steps separated me from the front row of seats in this overcrowded college retreat in a beautiful area of the northern United States. It was heaven to me because I love speaking to collegians and love being that close to the people. This college retreat fulfilled my requirements for perfection, and I gloated in the joy. The front row, as usual, lined up the most intense and interested people. It also held 1 or 2 very interesting people. Seated those 2 steps away and slightly to my right was a person who had the perfect unisex look. One could not discern whether it was male or female. Full-cut clothing and hairstyle masked all clues. Though I wondered, it presented no problem to me until one fateful moment I shall never forget. Speakers frequently borrow phrases and actions from other speakers when they feel it will enhance the eloquence of the moment. And plagiarism was not beneath me at that time, or frankly now. In an effort to increase the drama of the moment, I borrowed a statement from a well-known, at least to that crowd, evangelist from radio as I walked up to this unisex person and stated, "And that goes for you too, sir." Now, under ordinary circumstances and mental stability, this should present no problem. However, in the guilty realization that this phrase did not belong to me, my subproductive brain informed me that perhaps I had made a major goof, and this person was not a sir. I am now convinced that this event would have faded from my memory and theirs had I merely advanced to my next point without further rumination, but it was too late. To my own shock, I attempted to cover this bumbling slight to the person as I blurted out, "Or, madam." Now, I knew from experience that I must grab control of my message and go on lest I be lost, but my mind sucked me down a bottomless pit. I knew that if the person were female, she likely would not have been too offended by being called sir. Most girls live in peace with gender generics. However, I thought if it was a male, the male ego was less likely to be receptive to being called madam. Instant sweat and instant insanity. But I could not leave well enough alone. I bumbled once again, blurting out, or whatever. I instantly knew that no matter what he, she was, the term whatever would be unacceptable and totally offensive. I longed for some clue from the person's face with each term. Perhaps the eyes would light up when I spoke the appropriate word, although the humor of eyes lighting up at the word whatever almost made me lose further control. Now my mind swirled with the problem of my faux pas. I barely remained on any semblance of track as I finished my message. I constantly searched the face of the person seated only 2 steps away from me for signs of displeasure even, but it was deadpan. I longed for a shovel with which to dig my own hole and crawl in it. Misery. Afterward, I struck up a conversation with the person, probing, grasping for a clue to gender. None was forthcoming. Any negative or positive reaction to my statement was carefully masked. I did not know what to do. Pain stalked me. I watched carefully from a distance to see what group this person would seek. No clues. Always a mixture. I couldn't ask anyone the gender because that question would ultimately get back to the person and my sin would be compounded. Only the plane flight away provided relief. However, notice that now 25 years later, the quest remains. True relief still waits. Question. Are you free to describe your most embarrassing moment? What was it? 2. Have you ever tried to correct something and ended up creating more problems for yourself? Describe it. Evil Empire. My first trip to Russia occurred shortly after the collapse of communism. For a long time, we all knew that this godless system had to fall. Ronald Reagan spoke truly when he called it the evil empire. I was about to see for myself. To get to the Black Sea, where a discipleship training school of youth with a mission waited for me to teach, I flew to Moscow and connected on to Sochi. As we landed in Moscow, row upon row of parked passenger jets lined the edge of the airport, silent testimony to a bankrupt system that could no longer afford fuel or parts. The Moscow International Airport lacked convenient public transport into town, so friends met me and took me to a place to spend the night. Then I discovered that the domestic airport lay completely across town and out in the country. I wondered and then found out why. I realized communists do not want their people to travel, so they made it as difficult as possible. Further, they wanted to keep constant track of people, and such separated airports made that task easier. The next day, the long ride to the domestic terminal drove the realization further home. They especially didn't want foreign tourists, spies maybe, traveling in their country. I would soon find out how they handled them. I think they were embarrassed that we might see the truth of their poverty. The taxi ride had its own thrills. In the taxi, we ventured further and further from town, out into sheer country, then up a lonely forest-enclosed road. I began to wonder if either the driver did not understand where I wanted to go, or if he was taking me out to rob and abandon me. But sure enough, we turned into a large, virtually empty parking lot with a large airport terminal. I watched the two main entrances for a while, finally deciding which one was for departure, and entered. No crowd, and no check-in counters. I stood in the center of the hall and studied the sparse flight schedule on the electronic board. Finally, I deciphered the Sochi flight, but I saw no information to help me take the next step. I stood there for a long while and tried to think logically, having been in enough airports in my life to give it a try, but nothing clicked. I approached people walking in and asked if they spoke English. Nyet, nyet. Finally, a man who barely spoke any English pointed me outside and to the left. I walked out and saw a plain door, obviously for employees or maintenance, and walked back inside more confused than before. I walked to a door that others were going through, thinking that maybe the gates were behind that door. I opened the door and closed it quickly. That brief moment gave me a vision of the end of the world as I looked upon a mass of people and heard and saw what, in my scariest imagination, must approximate weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth. I stepped back, sweating and breathing harder. If I had to navigate that crowd, I needed some prayer and clarity of mind. I walked back to my middle-of-the-hall position and stared at that door. The agony behind that door overwhelmed me. What was I going to do? Once again, I sought English speakers. Once again, one of them pointed me outside and to the left. This time, I decided to forget the obvious and give it a try. I opened the plain, unidentified door and walked into a world of carpet, quiet, souvenirs, and Visa cards welcome signs. Then I remembered the old in-tourist system whereby the communist appointed a guide to each person visiting from the West, and that guide made sure that the visitor was exposed only to special rooms designed to impress and make him think that communism was a lovely success. Such a huge, expensive lie. I walked down the carpeted hall to a check-in counter. Only one person was ahead of me, and in just minutes I was checked in and held a boarding pass. The agent directed me upstairs to a restaurant and waiting area. I marveled at the contrast I had just observed. Heaven for the outsider, hell for the insider. By now my thirst drove me to the restaurant. I sat down in the available seat across from a well-dressed businessman. Soon we were in conversation. He worked for British Petroleum and was flying into the interior of the country. The intercom interrupted our conversation. My flight to Sochi would be delayed by 20 minutes. Well, 20 minutes seems to be the international airline opening salvo that usually ends up with the word forever. The businessman smiled at my concern and began his horror stories. The last time I had a 20-minute delay, he said, I was here 3 days waiting. And you have to wait here in the lounge. You cannot leave. Why? I asked. Well, usually, he continued, the flight is delayed for lack of fuel, but it may go at any time, so you dare not leave. My heart sank. I knew that any delay would destroy my whole trip, and I had no way to inform those who would be meeting me. After just 10 minutes, the Sochi flight was announced, and I cheerily headed to the security gate. Weary, bedraggled people passed by me as I walked. I spotted some American students with backpacks. So our Sochi flight is almost on time. Great. Oh, no, they quickly answered. This is the flight from 2 days ago. It's just now leaving. I gulped and walked back to the restaurant. By now, I was looking for good sleeping places and thinking about food. This could be an adventure I had not foreseen. However, to my pleasant surprise, my Sochi flight was announced, and I began my trek through security to the plane. I walked outside to a large plane parking lot and found mine only because people were walking toward it. I kept repeating the word Sochi as I walked, looking for nodding heads of approval. The plane held as many surprises for me as the terminal. This was Aeroflot. Perhaps that's all I need to say. Well, all Westerners were seated together in the same row where all the seat belts and seat backs worked. I noticed others that did not work. The overhead compartment shocked me most. Rather than the compartment with a door, as on all U.S. airlines, it was merely an open bench. Large pieces of luggage hung out over the seats. One good air pocket and there would be fatalities. However, just as much luggage filled the aisles. This would be an adventure. My mouth watered as I smelled some roasted chicken. I thought, well, maybe a meal would redeem this flight. Then I spotted the chicken on open paper in the lap of a passenger 2 rows behind me. He was the smart one. Service on the airplane consisted of 3 trips by the crew down the aisle. One was to sell newspapers, another to sell lottery tickets, a third to give a glass of weak-flavored water. When we landed at Sochi, we didn't actually land, we semi-crashed. We Westerners looked at each other as if this is it. Other passengers were unconcerned. I walked with everyone to the luggage conveyor under an open roof area similar to a fairground cattle barn. Conveyor might be stretching it a little, more like a place where luggage could be shoved. My luggage did not arrive. Sweats again until I realized, oh yes, there must be a nice place where my luggage would be placed. Sure enough, I walked up the way to an attractive entrance, and there, amid more conveniences, was my luggage and the person waiting to meet me. But I was glad that I had the opportunity to see how they treated the normal Russian passengers. By now, I had come to a firm conclusion. I was observing the evil empire. The scenery became more pleasant as we journeyed by train to our port town where the school was being held. After all, this is an elite resort town on the Black Sea. While at the port town, I made further discoveries. To make a phone call, one had to go to the post office, book a call and pay for it, and at the appointed time, return to receive the call as placed by an official. All phone calls went through Moscow, even if to a neighboring town. That way, with one switch, the communist leaders could disable the whole country's communication. Also, I discovered that Russian women must shop constantly. Why? Well, consumer goods are scarce, food delivery irregular. When items became available, they had to snap them up because they might not be available when they actually needed them. A Russian department store does not place items out where you can touch them. They are displayed behind glass or on walls behind counters. You point out what you want, and if it is available, they will hand it to you. Now, with my own eyes, I had seen the fruit of the evil empire. Question. If you are from the Cold War age, what promises do you remember that communism made to people? 2. What do you think the world will be like when Jesus reigns? Rain on parades. I settled into my aisle seat to fly from Kona, Hawaii, back to Los Angeles. A slightly disheveled wisp of a young lady slumped into the window seat and curled up into a fetal position. Pulling the thin airline blanket over herself, she looked at me and said, "I'm depressed and haven't had any sleep for 2 days. Please don't talk to me." Well, since she closed the conversation, I risked a question. "That's a tough combination. What brought it about?" She uncurled slightly and answered, "I'm an astronomer. Everyone in the world wants to get on the Keck telescope up on Mount Mauna Kea. After years of application, I finally achieved a 2-hour slot in the telescope, and it was cloudy for the whole 2 hours. I am bummed." After a short explanation of her planned observation, she drifted off into sleep. I pondered her scene and wondered how I would feel if my life's goal, my dream parade, was rained out. Now, the joy of serving the Lord flows from the knowledge that even the rain fulfills His purposes. What I perceive as failure may be the greatest victory. Chance becomes purpose. Coincidence becomes miracle. I remembered this encounter of these years ago because of a recent article in the Los Angeles Times. Another lady astronomer has discovered, using the Keck telescope, that stars are double stars as they are formed, which, in evolutionary terms, means that planets are impossible, which means our solar system is unique, which means it must have been created. The whole evolutionary parade seems to be getting rained on. Questions. What great ambitions of yours have proven unattainable? 2. What unexpected rewards have you received from God that had you singing in the rain? Rufus. Rufus Bohannon and Charlie Brown spent hours together. They were best friends. Charlie was my father-in-law. Both were godly men and leaders in the same church. Rufus, whom I knew well, had one interesting quirk. Whenever the sermon started, he went to sleep. It mattered not how interesting the speaker, nor how loudly he held forth. Rufus would be sound asleep. One particular Sunday, sleep came a bit early for Rufus, much too early, actually. As the pastor prepared to receive the morning's offering, he decided to ask Rufus to pray for the offering. Rufus was asleep. His wife, sitting right beside him, jabbed him in the ribs. Rufus woke with a start, looked quizzically at his wife. She merely whispered, "Pray." Rufus rose to the task, immediately stood, and dismissed everybody. The offering continued amidst the laughter. Well, Charlie and Rufus frequently got together for chat times. I hear them talking away in the living room, then silence. I check on them and find them both asleep. Charlie was a sleepyhead, too. Then, after a short nap, they awaken and continue the conversation right where they left off. Charlie and Rufus died within 24 hours of each other and were both in the same funeral home at the same time. I figured they said, "Hey, let's take a little longer nap and continue up there where we don't have to stop." Questions. Do you have anyone you often just chat with? How did that relationship develop? 2. Have you ever had anything embarrassing happen to you in church? Tell about it. Watch your head. Being only 5'8" tall protects me from the normal worries of all you tall people. For instance, most beds are long enough for me, and most watch your head signs can be ignored. My feet reach the floor, so I consider my legs long enough. Once in my life, I found my height to be a problem. I traveled to northern Thailand to speak at a pastor's conference held at a campground surrounding a soccer field. My room was a hut on the southern side of the field across from the open-air meeting hall. My bed, a mat on the floor under mosquito netting. The toilet, a small facility about 100 yards away. God blessed me with a lot of energy that begins early in the day. I awakened each morning and bounded up from my mat, forgetting that the open rafters of the ceiling were made for Thailanders, not me. Wham! My ears rang and unusual sights swirled around my eyes. 2 days to even cry out. I would go sit in the corner and wait for clarity to return and the pain to subside. It seemed that the blow would also knock the memory out of me, and each day I repeated the wham, groan, sit drama. Add to this the fact that I had not been careful about my eating and drinking. Maybe it was the red ant eggs I had, I don't know, but by the 3rd day, hourly visits provided great familiarity with the toilet, a hole in the ground over which you squat. 1 small problem. The door needed a mind your head sign, although I'm not sure it would have helped me, especially in the middle of the night. Wham! Now, when your intense need for the toilet is intersected by pain and minimized consciousness, you invent a whole new set of problems to consider. Unusual prayers like, "God, don't let me knock my brains out over here," flow from your lips. When I returned home, scratched and battered, it took answers to several suspicious questions before I could convince my wife that I had not been in a fight. Questions. 1. Does your body size or shape ever present problems for you? When and how? 2. What foods have you heard of that you think you would refuse to eat? Happy Trails. I joined the headquarters staff of a denomination to develop a new magazine for youth and some new youth programming. The new magazine I had in mind exceeded the skills of any designers that I knew. Miraculously, God sent an outstanding designer named Dempster Evans. When I saw his work, I invited him to be the designer of the new magazine, and he accepted. This was in 1969. Dempster flew in every other month from California, and we designed 2 issues of the magazine at a time. He always brought news of the latest happenings in the Jesus movement. Well, the glowing reports fell on my skeptical ears. Many glowing reports of past revivals disappointed me upon closer examination or in the long run. But then he began to bring newspaper clippings with photos of what was happening at Calvary Chapel of Costa Mesa. Being an old newspaper man, I knew these were not press releases, but actual news. My interest increased. "Well, why don't you come out and see for yourself? We can design issues out there as easily as here," Dempster said. That challenge by Dempster was all I needed. When I arrived, he told me we needed to get to the church at least an hour early to get a seat, hopefully near the front. I was amazed. Before, if I went to church early, it was to get rear seats. I was intrigued. We managed to get seats near the middle on that Wednesday night. Bodies occupied every available space, whether pew or floor. Strange-looking bodies. Clothing ran the range of styles. This was hippie territory. The stage was bare, containing only one stand mic, no thrones or decorations. The crowd chattered away excitedly. I liked what I was feeling. A young man with a guitar walked out to the mic and, without saying anything, began a worship chorus. Instantly, the crowd quieted and joined in. Often, when we stood and sang, they would wrap their arms around each other and sway as one unit. At the close of each song, they all raised their hands in the one-way sign. The speaker that night looked like an explosion of hair and gunny sack cloth. His simple message said, "If you're living together and get saved, you need to get married." At the close, he stated that if anyone wanted to get saved, to stand up. 100 people stood. No push, no stories, no manipulation. In the applause and hugs that followed those who stood, I was willing to stand myself. I was so thrilled by this event. The next night, the scene repeated itself. This time, the pastor, Chuck Smith, dressed in a simple turtleneck shirt, came out and sat on the floor of the platform during worship. Well, that was new to me, but I liked it. At the close of his simple message, "The Bible is the Word of God," another 100 people stood for salvation. By this point, I was overwhelmed, watching something that I had dreamed about all my life. I cried like a baby. Now I was putting it all together. Number one, everything was natural, nothing fancy at all. Even the speech was natural, no preacher twang. Number two, worship was simply that. No cheerleading, no pressure. The leader worshiped and we joined him. Three, a well-thumbed Bible was in every hand and the sermons followed it closely. Number four, the call for salvation was straightforward and without trickery, without manipulation or any psychological gimmicks. Number five, everyone, regardless of looks or anything else, was welcomed. Number six, Jesus was the center of everything and deeply loved. Number seven, the love that flowed to each other was overwhelming. Well, in coming to California, I didn't leave my heart in San Francisco. I left it in Costa Mesa. 4 years later, I moved there. And if you receive my newsletter, you know that my relationship with Calvary Chapels, now a movement, has only grown. It has been a happy trail. Questions. What's the greatest church experience you have had? Two, describe any events or discoveries that seem to fulfill your dreams. Those floating machines. As one pilot described flying as hours of boredom with moments of sheer terror, so many of us live routine lives with only moments of muscle-vibrating terror. Sometimes we merely call them close calls. At such times, if nothing else, we recognize our own vulnerability and mortality. Sometimes also these close calls come at times of high pleasure. My brother J.M. and I enjoyed sailing together whenever I visited him at his home on the Gulf of Mexico. Those moments were among my highest, especially one night as we sailed home on a warm sea. Plankton, glowing plankton, filled the water and illuminated our trail. We both broke into praise as two porpoises decided to join our sail. As brilliant, glowing torpedoes, they swam inches away on either side of us. Never seen such a sight before or after. Our sailing brought about another event that became legendary in our household. Whenever we sailed, my mother would begin immediate, intense prayer. She would call the Coast Guard and tell them, "Gentlemen, start your engines. The Irwin boys are on the ocean." Well, the reason for this is that we would always run aground and have to be rescued. Well, the reason for that is that my brother would turn the helm over to me. Though his instructions seemed simple, the top of the ocean looked the same everywhere to me. Also, there seemed to be more than one light to follow out there. Some were different colors, some blinked, some of them even moved. My incompetence bore its fruit. One such episode almost ended all of our sailing. We sailed along the coast until we came into Lake Pontchartrain, where we planned to dock the boat for the night. A breeze pushed us merrily along, though we knew an approaching storm line was cause for some haste. We did not beat the storm. About a mile or two from the safe harbor, the wind began to blow us in first one way, then the other. We could not get any speed in order to use our rudder before the wind would shift again. This troubled us. Then, absolute calm. That brought greater frustration with the harbor so close. We were pointed that direction, but totally becalmed. Night enveloped us. J.M. stood at the bow. I sat at the stern with my hand on the rudder. Suddenly, a powerful gust of wind hit our hanging sails with such a force that the front wire to the top of the mast snapped. The force splintered the tall wooden mast at its base and shot the sharp splinter straight toward my brother, while the top came crashing down toward me. With only millimeters to spare, it missed us. But we both could have been killed at that one moment. Now, drifting powerlessly, the wind driving us toward shore, where the boat would be beaten to splinters by the waves, we hastily brought up a small outboard motor to attach to the back and hope that it was stronger than the wind. The first job was to get the wires and sails out of the water so they would not entangle the propeller. With that finally done, and the shore coming rapidly upon us, we cranked furiously on the motor, but it refused to start. My brother hit it into the hold of the boat with a hatchet to beat a hole in the hull to sink the boat. It would be easier to raise and repair it later than to salvage its remains from the shore. Just before he began to hack away, one more crank produced the relieving whine of the motor. Though it was barely stronger than the wind, we inched our way into a safe harbor marina amid frequent expressions of thanks to God for what we considered to be a series of miracles. Dempster Evans, the designer of Youth Alive magazine and the man who introduced me to Calvary Chapel, was going to be in New Orleans and I in Mississippi, so we decided to get together on the coast and design two issues of the magazine. We developed a glorious plan. We would have my brother J.M. take us out on his sailboat into the Gulf of Mexico near a barrier island, anchor us there with provisions, and he would motor back in on a small skiff. Days later, he would return to bring us back. There, in the pleasantness of Gulf breezes and away from all distractions, our creative juices flowed freely. On our first day, after a design session that produced so much we dared not stop, we were mentally coasting at midnight on the deck before retiring. Moonlight made the sea magical. We decided that all magazine design should occur this way. Shortly before we began our relaxation time, a strange wind blew in that couldn't seem to decide what direction it wanted to go. I remembered that the boat seemed to go in circles around the anchor spot. Now, though the breeze had settled to one direction, it still blew with briskness. As we sat in the strength of the moonlight, I noticed a buoy, a channel marker, that I didn't remember in our sight when we anchored. I remarked to Dempster that it was most unusual to see a channel marker broken loose from its moorings and floating. As it floated by us, automatic thinking took over. I realized that if it was loose, it was floating against the wind and current. Then I knew we were loose and floating by the marker. Well, this required immediate emergency action. We were in danger of hitting the island and being destroyed on the shore. I had only minutes to respond. First, I must start the engine. My brother had carefully shown me how to do that before he motored away. Then we had to raise the anchor and get the boat turned back toward the channel. Forging against the current, the engine strained every muscle as we pulled the anchor in. The circling boat had wrapped the line around the anchor, yielding it useless. Now, powered and underway, where do we go? Roads in the ocean don't have centerline stripes. I knew that to move back straight toward the city would run us aground. I headed toward the nearest flashing light, then on to the next flashing light. When we arrived at the final light, I could see the lights of Pascagoula, Mississippi, and I knew we were in the right channel. I eased slowly into the harbor and with mild panic inched up to the dock of the harbor police. When we safely tied up and stopped the engine, I don't remember ever heaving such a sigh of relief. From a payphone inside, I called my brother, J.M. A glance at my watch showed it to be 3 o'clock in the morning. J.M. Hello, Gail.
Gail! Where are you? What are you doing? How did you call me?
He picked us up, and we spent the remainder of the night washing salt water out of our minds. However, though with only one evening afloat, the designs and ideas we developed were used profitably for years. Questions. Describe some times you felt you were in great danger and God rescued you. Number 2. What are your favorite times of recreation? Does your recreation ever create any side problems, such as soreness, expense, etc.? What are they?
Tsk, Gail. High school provided the best teacher I ever had. World class in his effectiveness, he was the reason I majored in chemistry in college. However, one particular practice of his fell far beneath my favorite line. Every 6 weeks when he assigned new grades, he seated us in the class laboratory in accordance with our grade. Top grade occupied the right front seat. Students were then seated in descending order all the way to Idiot's Row. One time, I made it. Top grade. I'll never forget that day. He placed me in the first seat. I waited patiently while he seated the lesser ones. When he finished and turned to come to the front to continue his lecture, the door opened and in walked a transfer student from another city. He looked at her and said, "Oh my, this class moves like lightning. You are months behind already. You need to sit right up front where you can see everything. Gail?" I got up, gave her my seat, and walked back to the only seat available in Idiot's Row. It would have been okay, except that everyone in the school knew how he seated people, and when anyone came into the room, they would look around and see me and say, "Tsk, Gail." I did everything to prove that I didn't belong back there. Every question asked, I tried to answer it. I was obnoxious. You know, I understand the Apostle Peter much better now in his impetuousness as he attempted to gain the upper hand in the fight to determine the greatest in the kingdom. Questions. What type of things do you do to improve your noticeability? 2. What, if any, honors would you be willing to decline? The story. Behind all these stories rests one overriding fact that fuels all of it. I am a follower of Jesus. My walk with him has opened more doors than I could ever walk through, put me around more people than I could ever meet, and brought me far more acquaintances than I could ever call confidants. Walking with Jesus has meant more fulfillment than any one person ever deserves and more adventure than one mind can dream up. This Christ walk created empathy and compassion otherwise impossible for me and altered all my ambitions. At His call, the ambitions of my youth were abandoned joyfully for a far greater goal. Not one subsequent experience ever awakened a remorse or longing for the past. In spite of all the difficulties, even tragedies that I've known as a person and family member, not one event has touched the joy that resides in my heart. I am a happy man. I wish all people were as happy as I. In fact, if there were one heresy I would like to believe, it is that all people would be saved. However, God honors the choices of people and will force no one into His heaven. Nonetheless, the one overriding goal of my life is that all who hear my voice might know Him. That includes you as the listener to this tape. If you will listen to the hunger of your heart, the wisdom of the ages, and the gentle pull of the one who loves you most, please begin your greatest story now by simply confessing your belief in Jesus as the Son of God and Redeemer of your soul. Then now, welcome to the family. The party starts now. The story will never end. By the way, if you do choose to follow Jesus after listening to all of this, please write to me at Box 219, Cathedral City, California, 92235. I'd like to send you some additional encouraging material. A bonus story. The plane had landed and emptied in Rochester, New York, on my flight from Toronto to Philadelphia. A clean-cut couple boarded the plane carrying a chubby infant and leading a 3 or 4 year old little girl. About 3 rows behind me, they seated the daughter next to the window and fastened their seat belts. Other passengers, bedraggled and weary from a day's work, began dragging themselves and their luggage down the aisle. Suddenly, over the clatter of baggage being stowed, I heard the delightful sound of a little girl singing to the top of her voice, "Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so." My heart and my face broke into a smile. It was the finest moment I have had on U.S. air.